Live from New York City, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. This is the place to come if you want to be empowered. We have so much to share today. If you're an older person over the age of 40, and you want to see how you can live a longer life and be healthier, we're going to share that today, along with about 17 other very important health updates, always from peer-reviewed literature, always from respected institutions, and things you have not heard or seen anywhere else. Then I have a guest in the second part of my program today. She is Dr. Stephanie Christner, and she is a physician, primary care physician, board-certified psychiatrist, and medical director of the Marion Medical Center in Tulsa, Oklahoma. And in the past, she actually served on the FDA's Vaccine and Related Biological Advisory Committee. Okay, what happened? What happened was that she had a daughter who was vaccinated, didn't turn out well. Then she began to actually read the scientific literature, and that shocked her. So you're going to hear from someone who has a strong academic background, thought she knew the truth about vaccines, and now is one of 3 million American women who are not believed or trusted by the mainstream media, by most feminist groups. There's no Me Too movement for her. There's trust, we believe you, but evidently not for women whose children have been vaccine damaged. What hypocrisy. It's palpable and a disgrace. You'll hear from her, and you can make up your own mind why this isn't a national issue, why we're not having open debates, why the people making these vaccines are not brought into Congress and held accountable, why we don't remove all vaccine the liability protection for them, indemnifying them. Why, if they make a vaccine that hurts people, why can't they be sued? We'll have that discussion. Also today, I want to go to your calls. We have a lot of them. Like to see what's on your mind. And so that'll be a big part of our program. We begin with the latest from York University, which is in Canada, published in the peer-reviewed Journal of Applied Physiology. Exercise. Now, I keep doing a lot on exercise because there's so much power in exercising. The newest research suggests that a relationship between physical and brain fitness is due to the virtue of exercising. So, the cardiorespiratory fitness is the measure of how much and how well oxygen is delivered to the muscles during exercise. Fitness levels have also been associated with changes in the brain's nerve-rich tissue. That's called your gray matter. And better cognitive function later in life, which means in lay language, if you exercise throughout your life, in effect, you're accruing positive health to your brain. So you're going to be the one that has better cognition, memory, and clarity as you age. And that's all in this latest study. So once again, exercise is foundational and essential for our well-being. I mentioned spirulina, S-P-I-R-U-L-I-N-A, spirulina. It's a single-cell algae, and the latest is from Shikoku University School of Health, which is in Japan, published in the Journal of Dietary Supplements, and it shows that spirulina can prevent the increase of fat in the blood by inhibiting a lipid metabolism and absorption. Now, in lay language, what does that mean? It means that we have about 100 million, more or less, Americans suffering from diabetes, about 30 million. The official figure is around 26, but it's higher because of all those that are not diagnosed. And then pre-diabetic, meaning they haven't been officially diagnosed, but they're right there. Their blood sugar, their fasting blood sugar is high. Those individuals with metabolic syndrome defects, when they take spirulina, they're benefited tremendously because by improving your metabolism, that's what spirulina does, and especially improving your metabolism if you have diabetes or prediabetes or if you're overweight, you're reducing the absorption of lipids, those are your fats, and that helps you. See, let me back up just a bit. Metabolic syndrome is a cluster of metabolic disorders. It occurs when individuals have at least three metabolic conditions that occur together, like elevated blood pressure, high blood sugar, excess body fat around the waist, abnormal cholesterol, abnormal triglyceride levels. All of these have something in common. They increase your risk of heart disease, stroke, and diabetes. And one of the main causes of metabolic syndrome is high consumption of calories. And while this condition may be improved through following a healthy diet, and it does, and exercise, spirulina also plays a role. And metabolic syndrome may also be improved by delaying or reducing the digestion and absorption of energy sources like lipids and carbohydrates. So that's what it is. So once again, with all the other things that this blue-green algae does, detoxifying our blood, helping to eliminate heavy metals, helping with the liver and the, especially if you've had hepatitis or sclerosis liver, it's terrific. From the University of Calaria, which is in Italy, lemons are a very cheap but very effective way to maintain good oral hygiene. Quite simply, good oral hygiene does not need expensive toothpaste mouthwash. Instead, according to this study using lemons and other citrus fruit have been associated with many benefits, such as lowering the risk of gastrointestinal and esophageal cancers, helping reduce cardiovascular disease. But in a recent study, it was also revealed that the extract of the rind of the lemon is a protective against oral health problems. It was published in the journal Medicines. The study showed that lemon rind, not the lemon, that's too acidic, that can actually corrode the enamel, but lemon rind extract is used in protecting the oral cavity against oxidative and bacterial injuries. Why? Well, the rind of the lemon and other citrus fruits is commonly considered just organic waste. It isn't. You should always juice the whole lemon, the whole grapefruit, the whole orange, the seeds and all. All of that is important. However, citrus rinds are actually a great source of phenolic, phenolic, phenolic compounds that have been shown to possess anti-inflammatory, antioxidant, antimicrobial properties. And so that's what they did. The researchers obtained the extract of the rind of lemons, and then it was in freeze-dried form, and then they took a look at the phytochemical profile of the extract and found that its most abundant component was gallic acid. Now, G-A-L-L-I-C, that's a very powerful acid. There's also a neohesperidin, and these are all important chemicals naturally occurring in the rind. And then they were able to deal with the oral cavity and found that all these irritants and pathogens that can bring about local disorders like microbial infections and cavities, periodontal conditions, precancerous conditions, gingivitis, and those are all increased by oxidative injury. So the lemon rind extract prevented oxidative damage and cell death and prevented bacterial growth. Something new. It's not currently in the United States, but doesn't mean that it won't happen real soon. And also one more reason why, one of the greatest discoveries supposedly in world history, DDT, I can actually remember as a kid, they were spraying it on the kids. That we would come out of school and they would spray all of us. It'd be just like all this fog. And everybody was very happy because we were being protected. Protected from what? We didn't have any diseases. But now we know how bad DDT is. In fact, yesterday afternoon, late afternoon, up in Vancouver, Canada, I was filming a person for my latest important full-feature documentary on the environment. This is a very wise person I was filming, and he had very outspoken views. And he said at my age, 80, I think he said he was 84, he's going to say what he believes, and if people don't like it, fine. And it was all about why we're not paying attention to the environment. He's not optimistic, but you can see for yourself what he has to say and his argument supporting it. But when we were having this whole discussion, he mentioned something about, look at DDT. When I was growing up, when he was growing up in Canada, he said they would, you know, spray everyone. Everybody got sprayed with DDT. He said, and you realize what the consequence was? That's why I became an environmentalist. My first book that motivated me towards the environment was Rachel Carson's Silent Spring, back in 1963. And he said, and I've been an environmentalist ever since. And he has, one of the world's most respected. I mean, he's a heavyweight. Right? He's probably one of the best known and best respected environmentalists on the planet. In any case, he was talking about the dangers of DDT and that even to this day we're still having adverse effects. Well, this is from Columbia University, this new study published in the Journal of the National Cancer Institute, the current issue. The DDT exposure is tied to breast cancer risk for all women through up their mid-50s. So all women exposed to high levels of DDT are at increased risk of breast cancer through their mid-50s, but the timing of the cancer risk depends upon when they were first exposed. And women exposed before 14 years of age, particularly in infancy and early childhood, were most likely to develop premenopausal breast cancer. So that's terrifying when you think of how many young women were exposed to DDT, didn't know it. It was sprayed all over everyone's lawns, and every place you could spray it, people were spraying it. And it was completely unnecessary. And now those people, with no other risk factors, could end up with breast cancer. Also, high levels of vitamin C can significantly lower your risk of premature death. This is from the Chinese Academy of Medical Sciences, which is equal to our National Academy of Sciences. Yes, death is inevitable, but there are lots of ways you can prolong your life. And a recent study shows that vitamin C is one of the best tools for giving yourself some extra years. I remember there was a group of physicians asked if I would do a update on the work I was doing at that time, the results of breast cancer, AIDS, heart disease, dementia, etc., at the Tri-State Healing Center. So they came over one Sunday late afternoon. There must have been 20. And we sat around, and I went through all the different protocols, and these were staggering to these people. They had never even contemplated you could go this high with vitamin C and alkyl vitamin A and glutathione. But then we started showing them the patients, and I had invited some patients to come who had end-stage diseases. And one of the patients who was there was a engineer, and he was given up. He was going to have to undergo an emergency procedure because he had 95% blockage in carotid artery. And if he didn't, his name was Ed Finkelstein. His wife's Dolly Finkelstein. She was head of nursing, and his daughter, a medical doctor. He was an engineer. And after 2 years, he had no blockages in his arteries. And joining the Natural Living Running Walking Club to learn how to walk and then how to run, he ended up running so well that he became Outstanding USA Track and Field Athlete of the Year, the New York Road Running Club Athlete of the Year, and the Metropolitan Congress Athlete of the Year for 5 straight years. That means in his age group, he was the best in America at running. Even one day he called me, he was all excited. He said, Gary, I just did a race down here in Philadelphia, and I just beat Ted Corbett, the former Olympic gold medalist. I said, well, What did you expect? You're putting the energy in, you're getting the results back. And that was an interesting case because none of these doctors who were there, three of them were cardiologists, could understand how do you reverse that? How do you unblock an artery? It's 95% blockage. That was not the only blockage, and repair and heal all the other arteries. And I said, you couldn't do it without vitamin C. There are other nutrients, absolutely, and it's a synergistic, holistic program. And his wife, Dolly, was not initially into it until she developed Bell's palsy, and she came in one day to bring him in, and her whole face on the left side was drooped down, her eye was closed, and she said that, you know, this could be irreversible. There's nothing in medicine can cure Bell's palsy. I said, let me give a try at it. 2 weeks later, she had no Bell's palsy. 2 weeks. 2 weeks reverse Bell's palsy. Suddenly, they were doing the protocol together, and she ended up being, guess what? Outstanding U.S. track and field athlete, the best women runner in her age group in America. New York, Metropolitan, National. And they were just as happy as can be as a couple together, but also their health was phenomenal. So when I was introducing them to Ed and other people with other diseases that had been reversed, I said, this would not have been possible without vitamin C. You're just not giving enough of it. And their arguments were, well, but you know, there's no science. I said, we're making the science. That's like telling, you know, imagine telling Thomas Edison, or actually it was Louis Latimer, an African-American who invented the first incandescent light. He would later go to work for Edison. Edison took credit for his work. But could you imagine saying, there's no proof that, you know, we can do something. Well, we're doing it. So we're the proof. Right? You don't have to have anyone else do something to see that you could do it. So we did it. No place in American history, no hospital, no clinic, no university, no one's ever cured as many people as we cured at the Tri-State Healing Center, over 4,000. And all the medical records were there, and we invited people to come. You could come from anywhere in the world and see what was going on. So it was all about the vitamin C drips. Now, jump ahead. Quote, published in the Journal of Epidemiology and Community Health, that's a major mainstream peer-reviewed journal, they looked at men and women between the ages of 53 and 84 who were put on a general population nutrition intervention trial. They were followed over the course of 16 years, and their blood was tested to determine their levels of vitamin C and other metrics. At the end of the follow-up period, quote, more than half of those studied had died, many of whom succumbed to problems like heart disease, stroke, and cancer. Among other causes, the research determined that the people whose vitamin C plasma concentrations ranked in the top 25% had the lower chance of dying from all causes compared to those who had the lowest levels of vitamin C. When it comes to specific illnesses, quote, the risk of dying from cancer or stroke was 28% lower in those with higher vitamin C. How about that? So, vitamin C's ability to lower cellular oxidative stress, and when left unchecked, oxidative stress can lead to arterial inflammation and heart disease, not to mention the DNA damage in cells and the growth of cancer cells. And a similar study done in Denmark on 100,000 people showed that those who had the greatest amount of fruits and vegetables changed their DNA. The researchers found the people who ate the most fruits and vegetables had a 50% reduced risk of cardiovascular disease and 20% reduced risk of early death. And mind you, that's not a lot of vitamin C. That's the amount you get out of an orange. Well, you take the amount I suggest, and you're eating you would have to eat, you know, 3 cases of oranges. So everybody's been underestimating what vitamin C does. We're downplaying it. There was one physician, I won't mention his name, but he's a, you know, board certified physician, and on his desk he kept a bottle of vitamin C. I happen to know that for a fact because one day I went by there and there was this vitamin C that looked awful familiar, and I asked him, how's that going? He just looked and he smiled. He said, And he says, I take this all day long. I said, how much do you take? He said, oh, I can easily take upwards of about 30,000 milligrams. He said, well, how much do you take? And I said, well, I said, I'm going to be doing a lecture tonight, a big lecture, big group in New Jersey. They're estimating about 6,000 people. I said, why don't you come? I want you to see something. So I took vitamin C, a lot of it. I mean, a huge amount. Now, normally, anyone taking a large amount of vitamin C, you know, they would end up with diarrhea. No diarrhea. I mean, where are you going to go? You're doing a lecture in front of all these people. You can't say, whoop, took too much vitamin C, be back in 10 minutes. No, you have to trust that your body can absorb. We've gotten everything wrong about vitamin C, but vitamin C has tremendous benefit to the body. And it's all these studies, and there are how many studies on vitamin C? Over 53,000 studies. So I just want you to know that this is just one of them confirming longer life with more vitamin C. And finally, chronic inflammation in middle age can lead to thinking and memory problems later. Johns Hopkins University published in the peer-reviewed journal Neurology. So when you're in your 40s and 50s and you're not paying attention to your diet, later, when you're in your 60s and 70s, your memory can fail because of this. So inflammation, acute inflammation, happens when the body's immune response jumps into action to fight off infection or an injury, and it is localized and short-term part of the healthy immune system. But chronic inflammation, and that's what people have today, that's not healthy. That creates low-grade inflammation that lingers for months, even years, throughout our body. And that creates autoimmune disorders. That's rheumatoid arthritis, chronic inflammation. Turn off the inflammation, you turn off the arthritis. Then you can rebuild the tissue. So they did a study with 12,336 people, average age 57, for 20 years. It was called the Atherosclerosis Risk in Community Study. And they found that inflammation affects your white blood cell count, your fibrinogens, your all these factors. So the more inflamed you are, the more likely you are to die. So I keep saying, inflammation, inflammation, inflammation. Get rid of the inflammation, and you can bring yourself back to ideal health. So that's important. That's the latest on health and healing. We're going to take a break and come right back into your questions.
I'd like to leave a message for Gary Knowles' show. My question is, I've heard a lot of negative things about coconut oil recently, and boy, I thought it was the best stuff. I've been eating it about a teaspoon to tablespoon a day. So I'd like to hear your opinion on the state of coconut oil right now. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Every so often, there's an item that is attacked. Veganism has been attacked, yoga is attacked, mind-body medicine by Wikipedia and its skeptics are attacked. Vitamin C was attacked. Of course, every time these things happen, we go through the actual scientific literature and we debunk them. We show that these are false. And sometimes it's because the people who believe in a paleo diet, a ketogenic diet, the caveman diet, it's all absurd. And we show that there's no science supporting it. But people get on television to sell a book, and suddenly people listen to them, and it sounds reasonable, so they go with it. Here's the reality. Coconut oil has all the science on its side, and it's all positive. A coconut oil, and you were mentioning like a teaspoon or a tablespoon, it enriches the Mediterranean plant-based diet. It improves cognitive function, especially with people with Alzheimer's disease. And this is from the Journal of Alzheimer's Disease. Read it yourself. I don't remember which one it was, but it's last year I read a study on it in the peer-reviewed journal because I read all the scientific journals every morning. So it's especially important if you have Alzheimer's, dementia. And coconut oil suppresses inflammatory markers in epidermis cells and protects your skin by enhancing the skin barrier function. And coconut oil has the benefits to manage hyperlipidemia and renal and hepatic dysfunctions. It reduces what I was just talking about, oxidative stress. It is especially important for people who are diabetic. Just read Endocrine and Metabolic and Immune Disorders journal, and you'll see that. Now, if you're healthy, and many of you are, coconut oil improves your fat-free mass, and the plasma HDL cholesterol in goes up, the good cholesterol, and you become even more insulin sensitive instead of insulin insensitive. And also, coconut oil can be considered an interesting approach for attenuating obesity because it can turn off the inflammation from obesity and it turns on metabolic activity. Also, the American Heart Association gave a warning that coconut oil is more than 80% saturated fat. That's beyond butter. Butter is, what, about 63%, and beef fat is 50%, and pork fat is 39%. And they say it has no known offsetting favorable effects. Well, they're just dumb to the bone. I don't trust anything they say. They claim coconut oil could actually increase LDL cholesterol. There's no proof of that whatsoever. Once again, they're sponsored. They accept money from food industries. But remember, yes, it is a high saturated fat, but not all fats that are saturated are the same. I've studied the background chemistry of saturated fats, including arachidonic fat from meat, and versus the polyunsaturated fats in coconut oil and the saturated fats. The saturated fats are antiviral. They're the medium-chain saturated fats, and they actually reduce obesity. And they induce outcomes comparable with long-chain fatty acids. So they're good fats. In fact, there's an article. I don't remember the article. It's been some time, but you could look it up. The Annals of Internal Medicine, a major difference. And so if you ate the monounsaturated fats and there's your olive oil and the unsaturated fats or the saturated fats on your heart or cholesterol, it's about the same. But you talk about using the medium-chain saturated fats, and extra virgin olive oil improves cardiovascular and liver conditions. So there's a lot of science supporting coconut oil, and that's peer-reviewed literature. We'll take another call.
Yes, hello, Gary. My name is Stephanie, and I listen to your program all the time. And I was wondering if you could talk about the HPV virus. I was wondering what kind of a treatment or a protocol you will suggest when someone has this virus. I would appreciate it. Thank you. Bye.
Okay, well, first of all, there's a new work out of Mexico, and I'm surprised it hasn't been reported in the United States. It was by an outstanding research team at their Polytech Institute where they were able to eliminate 100%, 100% of the human papillomavirus in the lesions by a light therapy. We're talking about light, pulsating light. That's one of the most important therapies for the future. But it's actually an old therapy. Go clear back to Royal Rife. He was able to reverse cancer using pulsed light therapy of different wavelengths and different colors of light. And if you doubt that light is powerful, ask why do all the laboratories in the world using bacteria or viruses have blue light surrounding them? Because it kills the pathogens. That's why. Now imagine if you were able to take that and you were able to find the frequency that a cell exists at, match that frequency, and then it shatters the cell. That's why light therapy is so powerful. I know one person in the United States, a former NASA genius, who has done the best work anyone in the United States of doing pulsating light therapy. So that would be number one. And you can go, I'll post the article. In fact, it was posted. It was posted up on PRN.FM. I think it was 2 days ago. So that's very exciting new news on that. But then I am not one of those people who believe that having a papilloma virus is in and of itself a death sentence or an absolute determination. You're going to end up with a cervical cancer. That's not true. And I'm going to get into that with my guest when she's on in about 15 minutes now. But the human papilloma virus vaccine, by the way, if you're thinking of that, it does not treat human papilloma virus, nor does it protect against all strains of the disease. And doctors still advise that vaccinated patients get regular pap screenings. That's your best way of determining any problems. And that suggests that those who don't trust the shot, and I don't believe anyone should be receiving the human papillomavirus or Gardasil vaccine. But that's not surprising given the research that I've been able to do and publish articles on it. And now they're trying to make it mandatory. They're lobbying for mandatory vaccination in all 50 states. And just a few years after it went on the market, Gardasil already had more adverse effects to the government's vaccine adverse reporting system than any other vaccine. I believe it was about 3 years ago, after approving the vaccine for girls, the FDA approved it for boys with no additional testing done, none. And by 2012, the HPV vaccine accounted for more than 60% of the adverse events in the data system. That's of all vaccines. That's how deadly it is. And tests themselves were based upon pure speculation. Since the development of a cervical cancer from atypical cervical cells takes about up to 40 years, and the studies only had their subjects for 5 years, and they picked a surrogate endpoint, atypical cells, without any evidence at all, none, zero, that these would ever develop into cancer. The entire premise for the vaccine is a fraud. And I've invited developers of the vaccine on my program to debate me on this, because I want you to see what kind of fraud Gardasil is and how these scientists working there know the truth. Why aren't they speaking it? So even then, the data was falsified. Merck falsified it by excluding women from its data who did not follow the exact protocol, as well as the lesions not of human papilloma type 16 and 18. And far from the 98% efficacy reported, the real efficacy rate is 17%, and it's only effective for 5 years. And worse, the vaccine actually caused more lesions in girls with pre-existing human papillomavirus 16 or 18 infections. And cervical cancer has declined sharply in recent decades thanks to widespread pap smears by falsely suggesting there's no longer a need for pap smears in vaccinated women. Merck and the CDC, I believe, are setting up women up for rebounding cancer rates. An increasing risk of birth defects, particularly central nervous system malformations and neural tube defects in fetal deaths, was found in pregnant women vaccinated with the Gardasil or human papilloma vaccines. And that was published in a major mainstream article in, it was Obstetrics and Gynecology. And so that's one way that I would not suggest you approach it. But if you want to know what to do to keep yourself healthy, first, have a pap smear on a regular basis. Secondly, vitamin supplementation has been shown to increase the clearing of the human papilloma infection, particularly folic acid, vitamin B12, and there was a International Journal of Women's Health found women who supplemented with B12 and folic acid were significantly less likely to develop a cervical cancer caused by high-risk human papillomavirus. I would also suggest vitamin A, vitamin C, vitamin E. In fact, I don't have the date of the journal, but it was the International Journal of Gynecologic Cancer. But the conclusion of that was that the patients who routinely took their multiple vitamins, including what I just mentioned, vitamin A, vitamin C, vitamin E, had a reduced risk of cervical dysplasia, of both the low and high grades, also the superstars, vitamin D. And we're talking about upwards of 50,000 units of vitamin D every 2 weeks for 6 months increased their regression rate by more than 50%, with 84% clearing the infection versus the placebo. Then you have green tea extract. I'm talking about both oral and topical. It's very beneficial in preventing and even treating genital warts. It improves the clearance of cervical inflammation and lesions. And, of course, you'll have people who don't trust traditional Chinese medicine as if they have 5,000 years of experience with billions of people to qualify it, and you only have your biased opinion. But there was a major study published in the Chinese Archives of Traditional Medicine where they were using radix, R-A-D-I-X, astragali. Now, this is common. This is a very powerful substance in herbal medicine, and also pori, P-O-R-I-E-A, and then rhizoma, R-H-I-Z-O-M-A, and cortex, philodendria. These are just ones that I would suggest and use for people if you want to have a higher healing rate and better virus clearance and less recurrence than routine Western medical treatment. So yeah, we have natural ways of preventing and natural ways of healing, and Gardasil is nowhere on that chart. Let's see, I'm looking at the clock, it's 36. We'll take one more of your questions, then we'll go to a break, and then we'll come back with my guest.
This message is for Gary Null, Daryl McPherson, Bronx, New York. Gary, my mom's 98 years old. She's going to be 99 this year, and she's beginning to develop a stoop. Would you speak about what practices would be useful in helping people with their posture?
Okay, well, the Alexander technique is probably your single best. It's a very, very good technique. There are books, there are CDs, there are DVDs. There are centers all across America, Alexander technique. It's not complicated. It's not expensive. And I would also, first I would do a cranial sacral adjustment, a series of them. I would do chiropractic adjustments, a series of them. I would do trigger point therapy, which is, again, it's a non-invasive technique where you may have some blockage, your mother may have some blockages and some muscle constriction. And when the muscle locks into a position, then we adapt. The body adapts to that limitation by trying to equalize the opposite side of the body. So you end up with, let's say, a distortion in your walking, a distortion in your hip placement, distortion in your back, and you adapt to that. And we shouldn't. So we can correct that by releasing, with trigger therapy, we can release the spasm, the block muscle, and then straighten out our spine and our vertebrae and strengthen the muscles with muscle exercises. And then if need be, then get an easy vest, a vest that is a brace. It's a brace on the back, so you're forcing the body up into a good position. I remember my friend Marty Feldman, he had terrible posture. And he wouldn't exercise. So I said, Marty, let's get you a back brace. And in fact, before he died, he was in the process of looking for back braces. So the Alexander technique and those all together. Okay? All the best. And you're fortunate to have a mother who's vital and otherwise cognitive and healthy and almost at 100. Good for you. Back in a moment with my guest. Please stay with us. I'd like to welcome all of you from all over the world. We're heard in almost every country in the world. And it's always nice to know from all the syndicated stations and the people who are listening over the telephone, downloading the shows. So we welcome you. My guest from Tulsa, Oklahoma is Dr. Stephanie Christner, C-H-R-I-S-T-N-E-R. I gave you her bio earlier in the program. She's a board-certified psychiatrist, medical director of the Marion Medical Center in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and she was also on the Vaccine-Related Biological Advisory Committee at the FDA. And she came to my attention when I was watching a very brief, like 60-second video that someone sent me, and it impressed me, so I said, let's bring her on to tell her story. Stephanie, it's nice to have you with us today.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm happy to be here.
You know how I feel about vaccines because I had Richard Gale send you 52 articles, fully referenced, fully documented, and
yes.
And five documentaries, right?
Yes.
Stephanie, you have already been practicing conventional medicine for some time before you had to face the harsh realities of what you didn't know. And you held the typical medical belief taught in every medical school throughout the country that vaccines are safe and effective, and they have contributed to the larger decrease and even eradication of infectious diseases. And the more we can vaccinate the entire world's population, according to Bill Gates and others, the healthier the nation and the world would be. So having a medical background, after you started your own independent investigation into the peer-reviewed literature, What did you discover, and what was most shocking about that journey?
Well, you're exactly right. I was trained in mainstream medicine. I had the belief that I was very naive and trusted that our government was looking out for us, that the medical system was looking out for us, that the CDC was looking out for us. You're taught that in medical school. So I was absolutely shocked and devastated to learn that that's not the case and that we're actually causing significant harm, the greatest harm I've ever seen in the history books, to our greatest resource, our children. I had friends that talked about vaccinations, but I couldn't have fathomed at all, which is the case of many people today. They can't even hear the concept that we could be doing something globally to our most precious children that would damage them. So it was an eye-opening experience, and it's probably been the biggest source of my grief after losing my daughter. My husband and I walk around and see children, and we call them the walking wounded. We have other children that are living, and we see things in them where they have been harmed. And I also look at myself. It really triggered initially right after my daughter died, and we ruled out the major things that a medical examiner will rule out. It became very clear that this was a metabolic mitochondrial issue and related to things like chronic fatigue syndrome, fibromyalgia, other behavioral disorders, and I can track back in my own medical history when those things started to become a problem for myself. So it's been a very, very personal journey to recover my own children that are living, to properly take care of myself and prevent further decline, and then spread the word. And one thing I got so involved in all of this research, ordering medical journals from all around the world, then realizing, wow, these are in books, and there's a National Vaccine Information Center, and people have been screaming about this for years. I got so involved in that I finally said, you know what, I got to go back to work and just do what I know how to do. However, when I got back to work, I continually would see the walking wounded, and so I had to find a way to deliver care to them, which turned out to be a very, very challenging mission. A lot of patients aren't ready for that. They don't understand it yet and what it takes to get better and to reverse the damage that's been done by not only vaccinations, but other environmental toxins that we're all mostly aware of.
Stephanie, from your own medical education, how much were you taught in medical school about vaccines?
I was not taught anything about vaccines except that vaccines are good for you. Everyone needs to be vaccinated, and it's what we do. I graduated in, 2000? Yeah, I graduated in 2000. So I thought, well, maybe times have changed. So I reached out to a friend of mine's daughter, who one has just recently finished medical school, the other one's in medical school, and asked, are you being taught anything different today? And the response was, honestly, I was not taught anything other than a few contraindications and that we should be really encouraging everyone to get them. So there is no more enlightenment in medical school teaching right now, despite everything we know.
There have been several so-called measles outbreaks recently, and the pro-vaccine officials and groups and the full support of the mainstream media is taking advantage of this to demonize parents and yourself and people who question and oppose mandatory vaccination. How many of these infected people were actually fully immunized with the measles vaccine? And will we ever really know? And we can't trust the federal government, to be honest, with any statistics or figures ever. And more recently, during the past week, we find more and more stories across the media about kids whose parents who oppose vaccination challenging their parents, where the teenagers are defying their parents. The parent is educated. The parent has done their homework. The parent, like yourself, has actually now read the literature, and the kid goes to the school and says, I want to get vaccinated. And they're vaccinating the kid, regardless of the parent's views. What are you hearing in your circles about these measles outbreaks and the fact that some children are rebelling against their own parents to get vaccinated? Your thoughts, please.
Well, so my thoughts go back to Hitler, totalitarianism, fascism. It's all propaganda that's going on. And living here in the United States, we think we live in a free democracy and that we are presented with the real information, but it is exactly the extreme opposite, and the media is involved with that. It's heartbreaking. It is propaganda that is absolutely false, and it's the parents. It's absolutely terrible. That's part of, again, my grieving process, is how backwards things are here and how brainwashed we are in mainstream medicine. And what is so terrible is that our doctors are a part of that, as well as the media and the CDC. And so it's going to take parents to continue to stand up, and people like yourselves who have been talking for years, and the Barbara Lowe Fishers of the world who have been speaking out, and other physicians. It's really, I think what's going to turn the tables is physicians who are injured themselves, have children that are injured. You can't walk down or into a school setting and not see the damage that's done.
Let's focus on that for a moment. You served on the FDA Vaccine Advisory Committee. Did you learn anything about the way our federal health agencies evaluate vaccine safety and efficacy that, in retrospect, based upon your daughter dying because of vaccines, and you were unprepared and unready to let's say, validate vaccines the way the government does because you didn't have the evidence? So based upon what you know now, should you begin to sound alarms for the other mothers and fathers out there?
Yes, so I think it's quite a funny story about me sitting on that committee. I was only on it very briefly. I was removed because they said I had a conflict of interest because my father holds some stock in a pharmaceutical company. So that's the first point. But the second point is that I was there in, I technically served from 2013 to 2015. And I was there, I think, when we voted in the 2014-2015 strains of the flu virus. And so there is, say, 20, 25 people. And they get up and give some information about last year's efficacy of the flu strain and how it was 110% ineffective in the military population. They went on to vote those exact same strains into the next year's flu vaccine, which ended up to be a failure. I think that next year it was maybe 23% effective, according to some numbers. There were handouts on every single person's chair. A wonderful handout from a woman from the East Coast writing about concerns of the flu vaccine. It was very detailed, extremely informative. They said, oh, we might get to this. No one ever read it. No one ever discussed it. Nothing at all. It was like going to a women's luncheon with a few men there and us voting in the strains of the virus for the next year. Completely unscientific with absolutely no science behind it. So if that's what people want to put their trust in, that's what they are putting their trust in, and it's Russian roulette.
One area of adverse vaccine reactions that do not feel, I do not feel is given enough attention is delayed reaction, which is what contributed to the death of your daughter. The most common stories are those pertaining to immediate adverse reactions. The child is perfectly fine and developing normally. He or she receives a vaccination, and within a day or two, the child goes despondent and is autistic. But then there are children who only show evidence of vaccine injury over the course of time, sometimes a year or two. And, of course, this would be relevant, but we're not paying attention to anyone who has a delayed reaction. Are there studies that you have seen that would refer, you could refer to that shows that we should be concerned about delayed reactions from vaccinations?
I don't have any studies right now that are coming to mind. But what the science shows is that we're seeing autoimmune problems. What is happening is we're getting this subclinical brain inflammation and encephalitis that leads to all of these neurodevelopmental disorders. These toxins come in and block the mitochondrial pathways, the metabolic pathways. And so this damage is so insidious and it's so widespread that it's very hard to detect. I don't know if I'm answering your question appropriately.
You are. You're telling us that you're seeing patients, you're seeing children who do not have the definition of autism, but have inner ear infections, chronic inflammation, allergies, asthma, and these also are part of vaccine injury, but we've normalized this. My final statement is this. We now live in a nanny state. We have people who want the government to determine how we should live our lives. And we're not paying attention to everything from asset forfeiture, a crime against the citizens, but no one is stopping it. No one's prosecuting those who steal. We have people telling us that how we should be vaccinated. And if we don't want to vaccinate, we're suddenly considered enemies of the state. And what is especially unconscionable and even criminal in my mind is how the federal health agencies and the drug industry have wrapped their tentacles around the entire mainstream media to keep people doubtful and uncertain that vaccines can pose any risk. And consequently, even when parents note very small but disturbing changes in their children following vaccinations, such as what I just mentioned, like small behavioral changes, they consider it normal and think it can't possibly be the vaccines. If not my pediatrician wouldn't do that, my favorite news channel or medical pundit or major TV network wouldn't lie to me, and our government all repeat constantly that vaccines are perfectly safe. So the pro-vaccine propaganda has become all-pervading. It is becoming near impossible to make any alternative view public. Now that you're more fully aware of vaccination risks, what are you observing differently in your patients now that you would not have noted earlier because you're no more are you blinded to vaccines' adverse effects?
Okay, exactly. So I will see young girls come in after the Gardasil vaccination who now have foggy head, behavioral disturbances, and can't pay attention at school. Now they're depressed. So it's really, the damage is done. It depends on your age group. So you have those younger children who will get these toxins, and based on their genetics, that they may present with autism and other issues earlier. But then you're seeing this adolescent population who now gets another toxic insult, who now presents with depression or psychosis. And you can trace it all back to some very, the methylation cycle, the detoxification cycle in mitochondrial SNPs. So we really could be screening people earlier and tell them what their risk is. Because if these toxins come in and you cannot detoxify the inflammatory molecules, you then go on to not produce the neurotransmitters that you need to produce for functioning. And really, so the research is showing, we are learning so much from autism. The research is showing that really the metabolic factors that lead to autism are what lead to most all chronic diseases today. And
well,
go ahead.
Well said. We're out of time, but I just want to finish with this. This is the irony. You're a board-certified psychiatrist. You realize that in the new definitions of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual number 5, you're now considered a psychotic because, or delusional because you have authority defiance disorder. How about that? Isn't that ironic?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Absolutely. I thought you'd appreciate that. So stand up to authority now with the truth, and you're labeled. Also, isn't it amazing? We say that we want to empower people, especially women, and we should. But we have disempowered intentionally and with malice aforethought over 3,500,000 American women whose children end up with autism spectrum disorder, and we don't give them any credibility. We attack them. We demarginalize them. And that is completely unconscionable. So welcome to the other side of truth. You're on the side now that will be attacked. The fact that you lost your daughter and then are accused of being an agitator, you've got a double negative, but in our eyes, you're going to be helping educate and inform and save lives. So good for you.
Well, thank you very much. Yes, it's been a journey, but we all have one, and I think this is the most important one. I do.
Dr. Stephanie Christner, we look forward to another conversation.
Yes. I do as well. I have a lot to talk about with you.
Thank you. I'm Gary Noll. We're out of time. Thank you all for listening. We'll be back to share more on tomorrow's program.